The design of the mind can encourage the train of theorization to go in that direction because of our drives for dominance and revenge, our habit of essentializing other groups, particularly as demons or vermin, our elastic circle of sympathy, and the self-serving biases that exaggerate our wisdom and virtue. An ideology can provide a satisfying narrative that explains chaotic events and collective misfortunes in a way that flatters the virtue and competence of believers while being vague or conspiratorial enough to withstand skeptical scrutiny. Let these ingredients brew in the mind of a narcissist with a lack of empathy, a need for admiration, and fantasies of unlimited success, power, brilliance, and goodness, and the result can be a drive to implement a belief system that results in the deaths of millions. But the puzzle in understanding ideological violence is not so much psychological as epidemiological. How a toxic ideology can spread from a small number of narcissistic zealots to an entire population willing to carry out its designs. Many ideological beliefs, in addition to being evil, are patently ludicrous. Ideas that no sane person would ever countenance on his or her own. Examples include the burning of witches because they sank ships and turned men into cats, the extermination of every last Jew in Europe because their blood would pollute the Aryan race, and the execution of Cambodians who wore eyeglasses because it proved they were intellectuals and hence class enemies. How can we explain extraordinary popular delusions and the madness of crowds? Groups can breed a number of pathologies of thought. One of them is polarization. Throw a bunch of people with roughly similar opinions into a group to hash them out, and the opinions will become more similar to one another, and more extreme as well. The liberal groups become more liberal, the conservative groups more conservative. Another group pathology is obtuseness, a dynamic that the psychologist Irving Janis called groupthink. Groups are apt to tell their leaders what they want to hear, to suppress dissent, to censor private doubts, and to filter out evidence that contradicts an emerging consensus. A third is animosity between groups. Imagine being locked in a room for a few hours with a person whose opinions you dislike. Say you're a liberal and he or she is a conservative, or vice versa. Or you sympathize with Israel and the other person sympathizes with the Palestinians, or vice versa. Chances are the conversation between the two of you would be civil, and it might even be warm. But now imagine that there are six on your side and six on the other. There would probably be a lot of hollering and red faces and perhaps a small riot. The overall problem is that groups take on an identity of their own in people's minds, and individuals desire to be accepted within a group and to promote its standing in comparison to other groups can override their better judgment. Even when people are not identifying with a well-defined group, they are enormously influenced by the people around them. One of the great lessons of Stanley Milgram's experiments on obedience to authority, widely appreciated by psychologists, is the degree to which the behavior of the participants depended on the immediate social milieu. Before he ran the experiment, Milgram polled his colleagues, students, and a sample of psychiatrists on how far they thought the participants would go when an experimenter instructed them to shock a fellow participant. The respondents unanimously predicted that few would exceed 150 volts, the level at which the victim demands to be freed, that just 4% would go up to 300 volts, the setting that bore the warning, danger, severe shock, and that only a handful of psychopaths would go all the way to the highest shock the machine could deliver, the setting labeled 450 volts, XXX. In fact, 65% of the participants went all the way to the maximum shock, long past the point when the victim's agonized protests had turned to an eerie silence. And they might have kept on shocking the presumably comatose subject, or his corpse, had the experimenter not brought the proceedings to a halt. The percentage barely budged with the sex, age, or occupation of the participants, and it varied only a small amount with their personalities. What did matter was the physical proximity of other people and how they behaved. When the experimenter was absent and his instructions were delivered over the telephone or in a recorded message, obedience fell. When the victim was in the same room instead of an adjacent booth, obedience fell. And when the participant had to work in tandem with the second participant, a confederate of the experimenter, then if the confederate refused to comply, so did the participant. But when the confederate complied, more than 90% of the time, the participant did too. People take their cues on how to behave from other people. This is a major conclusion of the golden age of social psychology, when experiments were a kind of guerrilla theater designed to raise consciousness about the dangers of mindless conformity. Following a 1964 news report, almost entirely apocryphal, that dozens of New Yorkers watched impassively as a woman named Kitty Genovese was raped and stabbed to death in their apartment courtyard, the psychologists John Darley and Bib Latané conducted a series of ingenious studies on so-called bystander apathy. The psychologists suspected that groups of people might fail to respond to an emergency that would send an isolated person leaping to action, because in a group, everyone assumes that if no one else is doing anything, the situation couldn't be all that dire. In one experiment, as a participant was filling out a questionnaire, he or she heard a loud crash and a voice calling out from behind a partition, "Oh, my foot! I can't move it! Oh, my ankle! I can't get this thing off me!" Believe it or not, the participant was sitting with a confederate who continued to fill out the questionnaire as if nothing was happening. 80% of the time, the participant did nothing too. When the participants were alone, only 30% failed to respond. People don't even need to witness other people behaving callously to behave in uncharacteristically callous ways. It is enough to place them in a fictive group that is defined as being dominant over another one. In another classic psychology experiment come morality play, conducted in 1971, before committees for the protection of human subjects put the kibosh on the genre, Philip Zimbardo set up a mock prison in the basement of the Stanford Psychology Department, divided the participants at random into prisoners and guards, and even got the Palo Alto police to arrest the prisoners and haul them to the campus huskow. Acting as the prison superintendent, Zimbardo suggested to the guards that they could flaunt their power and instill fear in the prisoners, and he reinforced the atmosphere of group dominance by outfitting the guards with uniforms, batons, and mirrored sunglasses, while dressing the prisoners in humiliating smocks and stocking caps. Within 2 days, some of the guards took their roles too seriously and began to brutalize the prisoners, forcing them to strip naked, clean toilets with their bare hands, do push-ups with the guards standing on their backs, or simulate sodomy. After 6 days, Zimbardo had to call off the experiment for the prisoners' safety. Decades later, Zimbardo wrote a book that analogized the unplanned abuses in his own faux prison to the unplanned abuses at the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, arguing that a situation in which a group of people is given authority over another group can bring out barbaric behavior in individuals who might never display it in other circumstances. Many historians of genocide, like Christopher Browning and Benjamin Valentino, have invoked the experiments of Milgram, Darley, Zimbardo, and other social psychologists to make sense of the puzzling participation, or at least acquiescence, of ordinary people in unspeakable atrocities. Bystanders often get caught up in the frenzy around them and join in the looting, gang rapes, and massacres. During the Holocaust, soldiers and policemen rounded up unarmed civilians, lined them up in front of pits, and shot them to death, not out of animus to the victims or a commitment to Nazi ideology, but so that they would not shirk their responsibilities or let down their brothers in arms. Most of them were not even coerced by a threat of punishment for insubordination. My own experiments in carrying out instructions to shock a laboratory rat against my better judgment makes this disturbing claim utterly believable to me. Historians have found few, if any, cases in which a German policeman, soldier, or guard suffered a penalty for refusing to carry out the Nazis' orders. As we shall see in the next chapter, people even moralize conformity and obedience. One component of the human moral sense, amplified in many cultures, is the elevation of conformity and obedience to praiseworthy virtues. Milgram ran his experiments in the 1960s and early 1970s, and as we have seen, many attitudes have changed since then. It's natural to wonder whether Westerners today would still obey the instructions of an authority figure to brutalize a stranger. The Stanford prison experiment is too bizarre to replicate exactly today. But 33 years after the last of the obedience studies, the social psychologist Jerry Berger figured out a way to carry out a new one that would pass ethical muster in the world of 2008. He noticed that in Milgram's original studies, the 150-volt mark, when the victim first cries out in pain and protest, was a point of no return. If a participant didn't disobey the experimenter then, 80% of the time he or she would continue to the highest shock on the board. So Berger ran Milgram's procedure, but broke off the experiment at that 150-volt mark, immediately explaining the study to the participants and preempting the awful progression in which so many people tortured a stranger over their own misgivings. The question is, after 4 decades of fashionable rebellion, bumper stickers that advise the reader to question authority, and a growing historical consciousness that ridicules the excuse, "I was only following orders," do people still follow the orders of an authority to inflict pain on a stranger? The answer is that they do. 70% of the participants went all the way to 150 volts, and so, we have reason to believe, would have continued to fatal levels if the experimenter had permitted it. On the bright side, almost twice as many people disobeyed the experimenter in the 2000s as did in the 1960s, 30% as compared to 17.5%, and the figure might have been even higher if the diverse demographics of the recent study pool had been replaced by the white bread homogeneity of the earlier ones. But a majority of people will still hurt a stranger against their own inclinations if they see it as part of a legitimate project in their society. Why do people so often impersonate sheep? It's not that conformity is inherently irrational. Many heads are better than one. And it's usually wiser to trust the hard-won wisdom of millions of people in one's culture than to think that one is a genius who can figure everything out from scratch. Also, conformity can be a virtue in what game theorists call coordination games, where individuals have no rational reason to choose a particular option other than the fact that everyone else has chosen it. Driving on the right or the left side of the road is a classic example. Here is a case in which you really don't want to march to the beat of a different drummer. Paper currency, internet protocols, and the language of one's community are other examples. But sometimes the advantage of conformity to each individual can lead to pathologies in the group as a whole. A famous example is the way an early technological standard can gain a toehold among a critical mass of users who use it because so many other people are using it, and thereby lock out superior competitors. According to some theories, these network externalities explain the success of English spelling, the QWERTY keyboard, VHS video cassettes, and Microsoft software, though there are doubters in each case. Another example is the unpredictable fortunes of bestsellers, fashions, top 40 singles, and Hollywood blockbusters. The mathematician Duncan Watts set up 2 versions of a website in which users could download GarageBand rock music. In one version, users could not see how many times a song had already been downloaded. The differences in popularity among songs were slight, and they tended to be stable from one run of the study to another. But in the other version, people could see how popular a song had been. These users tended to download the popular songs, making them more popular still, in a runaway positive feedback loop. The amplification of small initial differences led to large chasms between a few smash hits and many duds, and the hits and duds often changed places when the study was rerun. Whether you call it herd behavior, the cultural echo chamber, the rich get richer, or the Matthew effect, our tendency to go with the crowd can lead to an outcome that is collectively undesirable. But the cultural products in these examples, buggy software, mediocre novels, 1970s fashion, are fairly innocuous. Can the propagation of conformity through social networks actually lead people to sign on to ideologies they don't find compelling and carry out acts they think are downright wrong? Ever since the rise of Hitler, a debate has raged between two positions that seem equally unacceptable: that Hitler single-handedly duped an innocent nation, and that the Germans would have carried out the Holocaust without him. Careful analyses of social dynamics show that neither explanation is exactly right, but that it's easier for a fanatical ideology to take over a population than common sense would allow. There is a maddening phenomenon of social dynamics variously called pluralistic ignorance, the spiral of silence, and the Abilene paradox, after an anecdote in which a Texan family takes an unpleasant trip to Abilene one hot afternoon because each member thinks the others want to go. People may endorse a practice or opinion they deplore because they mistakenly think that everyone else favors it. A classic example is the value that college students place on drinking till they puke. In many surveys, it turns out that every student, questioned privately, thinks that binge drinking is a terrible idea, but each is convinced that his peers think it's cool. Other surveys have suggested that gay bashing by young toughs, racial segregation in the American South, honor killings of unchaste women in Islamic societies, and tolerance of the terrorist group ETA among Basque citizens of France and Spain may owe their longevity to spirals of silence. The supporters of each of these forms of group violence did not think it was a good idea so much as they thought that everyone else thought it was a good idea. Can pluralistic ignorance explain how extreme ideologies may take root among people who ought to know better? Social psychologists have long known that it can happen with simple judgments of fact. In another Hall of Fame experiment, Solomon Asch placed his participants in a dilemma right out of the movie Gaslight. Seated around a table with seven other participants, as usual, stooges, they were asked to indicate which of three very different lines had the same length as a target line, an easy call. The six stooges who answered before the participant each gave a patently wrong answer. When their turn came, three-quarters of the real participants defied their own eyeballs and went with the crowd. But it takes more than the public endorsement of a private falsehood to set off the madness of crowds. Pluralistic ignorance is a house of cards. As the story of the emperor's new clothes makes clear, all it takes is one little boy to break the spiral of silence, and a false consensus will implode. Once the emperor's nakedness became common knowledge, pluralistic ignorance was no longer possible. The sociologist Michael Macy suggests that for pluralistic ignorance to be robust against little boys and other truth-tellers, it needs an additional ingredient: enforcement. People not only avow a preposterous belief that they think everyone else avows, but they punish those who fail to avow it, largely out of the belief, also false, that everyone else wants it enforced. Macy and his colleagues speculate that false conformity and false enforcement can reinforce each other, creating a vicious circle that can entrap a population into an ideology that few of them accept individually. Why would someone punish a heretic who disavows a belief that the person himself or herself rejects? Macy et al. Speculate that it's to prove their sincerity, to show other enforcers that they are not endorsing a party line out of expedience, but believe it in their hearts. That shields them from punishments by their fellows, who may, paradoxically, only be punishing heretics out of fear that they will be punished if they don't. The suggestion that unsupportable ideologies can levitate in mid-air by various circles of punishment of those who fail to punish has some history behind it. During witch hunts and purges, people get caught up in cycles of preemptive denunciation. Everyone tries to out a hidden heretic before the heretic outs him. Signs of heartfelt conviction become a precious commodity. Solzhenitsyn recounted a party conference in Moscow that ended with a tribute to Stalin. Everyone stood and clapped wildly for 3 minutes, then four, then five, and then no one dared to be the first to stop. After 11 minutes of increasingly stinging palms, A factory director on the platform finally sat down, followed by the rest of the grateful assembly. He was arrested that evening and sent to the gulag for 10 years. People in totalitarian regimes have to cultivate thoroughgoing thought control, lest their true feelings betray them. Zheng Chang, a former Red Guard and then a historian and memoirist of life under Mao, wrote that on seeing a poster that praised Mao's mother for giving money to the poor, she found herself quashing the heretical thought that the great leader's parents had been rich peasants, the kind of people now denounced as class enemies. Years later, when she heard a public announcement that Mao had died, she had to muster every ounce of thespian ability to pretend to cry. To show that a spiral of insincere enforcement can ensconce an unpopular belief, Macy, together with his collaborators Damon Centola and Rob Willer, first had to show that the theory was not just plausible, but mathematically sound. It's easy to prove that pluralistic ignorance, once it is in place, is a stable equilibrium, because no one has an incentive to be the only deviant in a population of enforcers. The trick is to show how a society can get there from here. Hans Christian Andersen had his readers suspend disbelief in his whimsical premise that an emperor could be hoodwinked into parading around naked. Ash paid his stooges to lie. But how could a false consensus entrench itself in a more realistic world? The three sociologists simulated a little society in a computer consisting of two kinds of agents. There were true believers who always comply with the norm and denounce non-compliant neighbors if they grow too numerous. And there were private but pusillanimous skeptics who comply with the norm if a few of their neighbors are enforcing it, and enforce the norm themselves if a lot of their neighbors are enforcing it. If these skeptics aren't bullied into conforming, they can go the other way and enforce skepticism among their conforming neighbors. Macy and his collaborators found that unpopular norms can become entrenched in some, but not all, patterns of social connectedness. If the true believers are scattered throughout the population and everyone can interact with everyone else, the population is immune to being taken over by an unpopular belief. But if the true believers are clustered within a neighborhood, they can enforce the norm among their more skeptical neighbors, who, overestimating the degree of compliance around them and eager to prove that they do not deserve to be sanctioned, enforce the norm against each other and against their neighbors. This can set off cascades of false compliance and false enforcement that saturate the entire society.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined, by Steven Pinker, performed by Arthur Morey. The analogy to real societies is not far-fetched. James Payne documented a common sequence in the takeover of Germany, Italy, and Japan by fascist ideologies in the 20th century. In each case, a small group of fanatics embraced a naive, vigorous ideology that justifies extreme measures, including violence, recruited gangs of thugs willing to carry out the violence, and intimidated growing segments of the rest of the populations into acquiescence. Macy and his collaborators played with another phenomenon that was first discovered by Milgram: the fact that every member of a large population is connected to everyone else by a short chain of mutual acquaintances. 6 degrees of separation, according to the popular meme. They laced their virtual society with a few random long-distance connections, which allowed agents to be in touch with other agents with fewer degrees of separation. Agents could thereby sample the compliance of agents in other neighborhoods, disabuse themselves of a false consensus, and resist the pressure to comply or enforce. The opening up of neighborhoods by long-distance channels dissipated the enforcement of the fanatics and prevented them from intimidating enough conformists into setting off a wave that could swamp the society. One is tempted toward the moral that open societies with freedom of speech and movement and well-developed channels of communication are less likely to fall under the sway of delusional ideologies. Macy, Willer, and Co. Kuwabara then wanted to show the false consensus effect in real people. That is, to see if people could be cowed into criticizing other people whom they actually agreed with if they feared that everyone else would look down on them for expressing their true beliefs. The sociologists mischievously chose two domains where they suspected that opinions are shaped more by a terror of appearing unsophisticated than by standards of objective merit: wine tasting and academic scholarship. In the wine tasting study, Macy et al. First whipped their participants into a self-conscious lather by telling them they were part of a group that had been selected for its sophistication in appreciating fine art. The group would now take part in the centuries-old tradition, in fact, concocted by the experimenters, called a Dutch round. A circle of wine enthusiasts first evaluate a set of wines and then evaluate one another's wine-judging abilities. Each participant was given 3 cups of wine and asked to grade them on bouquet, flavor, aftertaste, robustness, and overall quality. In fact, the 3 cups had been poured from the same bottle, and one was spiked with vinegar. As in the ash experiment, the participants, before being asked for their own judgments, witnessed the judgments of 4 stooges, who rated the vinegary sample higher than one of the unadulterated samples and rated the other one best of all. Not surprisingly, about half the participants defied their own taste buds and went with the consensus. Then a 6th participant, also a stooge, rated the wines accurately. Now it was time for the participants to evaluate one another, which some did confidentially and others did publicly. The participants who gave their ratings confidentially respected the accuracy of the honest stooge and gave him high marks, even if they themselves had been browbeaten into conforming. But those who had to offer their ratings publicly compounded their hypocrisy by downgrading the honest rater. The experiment on academic writing was similar, but with an additional measure at the end. The participants, all undergraduates, were told they had been selected as part of an elite group of promising scholars. They had been assembled, they learned, to take part in the venerable tradition called the Bloomsbury Literary Round Table, in which readers publicly evaluate a text and then evaluate each other's evaluation skills. They were given a short passage to read by Robert Nelson, Ph.D., a MacArthur Genius Grant recipient, and Albert W. Newcomb Professor of Philosophy at Harvard University. There is no such professor or professorship. The passage, called Differential Topology and Homology, had been excerpted from Alan Sokol's Transgressing the Boundaries, Towards a Transformative Hermeneutics of Quantum Gravity. The essay was, in fact, the centerpiece of the famous Sokol hoax, in which the physicist had written a mass of gobbledygook and, confirming his worst suspicions about scholarly standards in the postmodernist humanities, got it published in the prestigious journal Social Text. The participants, to their credit, were not impressed by the essay when they rated it in private. But when they rated it in public, after seeing 4 stooges give it glowing evaluations, they gave it high evaluations too. And when they then rated their fellow raters, including an honest 6th one, who gave the essay the low rating it deserved, they gave him high marks in private, but low marks in public. Once again, the sociologists had demonstrated that people not only endorse an opinion they do not hold, if they mistakenly believe everyone else holds it, but they falsely condemn someone else who fails to endorse the opinion. The extra step in this experiment was that Macy et al. Got a new group of participants to rate whether the first batch of participants had sincerely believed that the nonsensical essay was good. The new raters judged that the ones who condemned the honest rater were more sincere in their misguided belief than the ones who chose not to condemn him. It confirms Macy's suspicion that enforcement of a belief is perceived as a sign of sincerity, which in turn supports the idea that people enforce beliefs they don't personally hold to make themselves look sincere. And that, in turn, supports their model of pluralistic ignorance, in which a society can be taken over by a belief system that the majority of its members do not hold individually. It's one thing to say that a sour wine has an excellent bouquet, or that academic balderdash is logically coherent. It's quite another to confiscate the last bit of flour from a starving Ukrainian peasant, or to line up Jews at the edge of a pit and shoot them. How could ordinary people, even if they were acquiescing to what they thought was a popular ideology, overcome their own consciences and perpetrate such atrocities? The answer harks back to the moralization gap. Perpetrators always have at their disposal a set of self-exculpatory stratagems that they can use to reframe their actions as provoked, justified, involuntary, or inconsequential. In the examples I mentioned in introducing the moralization gap, perpetrators rated a harm they committed out of self-interested motives, reneging on a promise, robbing or raping a victim. But people also rationalize harms they have been pressured into committing in the service of someone else's motives. They can edit their beliefs to make the action seem justifiable to themselves, the better to justify it to others. This process is called cognitive dissonance reduction, and it is a major tactic of self-deception. Social psychologists like Milgram, Zimbardo, Baumeister, Leon Festinger, Albert Bandura, and Herbert Kelman have documented that people have many ways of reducing the dissonance between the regrettable things they sometimes do and their ideal of themselves as moral agents. One of them is euphemism, the reframing of a harm in words that somehow make it feel less immoral. In his 1946 essay, Politics and the English Language, George Orwell famously exposed the way governments could cloak atrocities in bureaucracies. In our time, political speech and writing are largely the defense of the indefensible. Things like the continuance of British rule in India, the Russian purges and deportations, the dropping of the atom bombs on Japan can indeed be defended, but only by arguments which are too brutal for most people to face, and which do not square with the professed aims of the political parties. Thus, political language has to consist largely of euphemism, question-begging, and sheer, cloudy vagueness. Defenseless villages are bombarded from the air, the inhabitants driven out into the countryside, the cattle machine-gunned, the huts set on fire with incendiary bullets. This is called pacification. Millions of peasants are robbed of their farms and sent trudging along the roads with no more than they can carry. This is called transfer of population, or rectification of frontiers. People are imprisoned for years without trial, or shot in the back of the neck, or sent to die of scurvy in Arctic lumber camps. This is called elimination of unreliable elements. Such phraseology is needed if one wants to name things without calling up mental pictures of them. Orwell was wrong about one thing, that political euphemism was a phenomenon of his time. A century and a half before Orwell, Edmund Burke complained about the euphemisms emanating from revolutionary France. The whole compass of the language is tried to find synonymies and circumlocutions for massacres and murder. Things are never called by their common names. Massacre is sometimes called agitation, sometimes effervescence, sometimes excess, sometimes too continued an exercise of a revolutionary power. Recent decades have seen, to take a few examples, collateral damage from the 1970s, ethnic cleansing from the 1990s, and extraordinary rendition from the 2000s. Euphemism can be effective for several reasons. Words that are literal synonyms may contrast in their emotional coloring, like slender and skinny, fat and Rubenesque, or an obscene word and its genteel synonym. In The Stuff of Thought, I argued that most euphemisms work more insidiously, not by triggering reactions to the words themselves, but by engaging different conceptual interpretations of the state of the world. For example, a euphemism can confer plausible deniability on what is essentially a lie. A listener unfamiliar with the facts could understand transfer of population to imply moving vans and train tickets. A choice of words can also imply different motives and hence different ethical valuations. Collateral damage implies that a harm was an unintended byproduct rather than a desired end, and that makes a legitimate moral difference. One could almost use collateral damage with a straight face to describe the hapless worker on the sidetrack who was sacrificed to prevent the runaway trolley from killing five workers on the main one. All of these phenomena, emotional connotation, plausible deniability, and the ascription of motives, can be exploited to alter the way an action is construed. A second mechanism of moral disengagement is gradualism. People can slide into barbarities a baby step at a time that they would never undertake in a single plunge, because at no point does it feel like they are doing anything terribly different from the current norm. An infamous historical example is the Nazis' euthanizing of the handicapped and mentally retarded, and their disenfranchisement, harassment, ghettoization, and deportation of the Jews, which culminated in the events referred to by the ultimate euphemism, the final solution. Another example is the phrasing of decisions in the conduct of war. Material assistance to an ally can morph into military advisors and then into escalating numbers of soldiers, particularly in a war of attrition. The bombing of factories can shade into the bombing of factories near neighborhoods, which can shade into the bombing of neighborhoods. It's unlikely that any participant in the Milgram experiment would have zapped the victim with a 450-volt shock on the first trial. The participants were led to that level in an escalating series, starting with a mild buzz. Milgram's experiment was what game theorists call an escalation game, which is similar to a war of attrition. If the participant withdraws from the experiment as the shocks get more severe, he forfeits whatever satisfaction he might have enjoyed from carrying out his responsibilities and advancing the cause of science, and thus would have nothing to show for the anxiety he has suffered and the pain he has caused the victim. At each increment, it always seems to pay to stick it out one trial longer and hope that the experimenter will announce that the study is complete. A third disengagement mechanism is the displacement or diffusion of responsibility. Milgram's mock experimenter always insisted to the participants that he bore full responsibility for whatever happened. When the patter was rewritten and the participant was told that he or she was responsible, compliance plummeted. We have already seen that a second willing participant emboldens the first. Bandura showed that the diffusion of responsibility is a critical factor. When participants in a Milgram-like experiment think that the voltage they have chosen will be averaged with the levels chosen by two other participants, they give stronger shocks. The historical parallels are obvious. "I was only following orders," is the cliched defense of accused war criminals. And murderous leaders deliberately organize armies, killing squads, and the bureaucracies behind them in such a way that no single person can feel that his actions are necessary or sufficient for the killings to occur. A fourth way of disabling the usual mechanisms of moral judgment is distancing. We have seen that unless people are in the throes of a rampage or have sunk into sadism, they don't like harming innocent people directly and up close. In the Milgram studies, bringing the victim into the same room as the participant reduced the proportion of participants who delivered the maximum shock by a third, and requiring the participant to force the victim's hand down onto an electrode plate reduced it by more than half. It's safe to say that the pilot of the Enola Gay who dropped the atomic bomb over Hiroshima would not have agreed to immolate 100,000 people with a flamethrower one at a time. And as we saw in Chapter 5, Paul Slovak has confirmed the observation attributed to Stalin that one death is a tragedy, but a million deaths is a statistic. People cannot wrap their minds around large or even small numbers of people in peril, but will readily mobilize to save the life of a single person with a name and a face. A fifth means of jiggering the moral issue is to derogate the victim. We have seen that demonizing and dehumanizing a group can pave the way toward harming its members. Bandura confirmed this sequence by allowing some of his participants to overhear the experimenter making an offhand derogatory remark about the ethnicity of a group of people who, they thought, were taking part in the study. The participants who overheard the remark upped the voltage of the shocks they gave to those people. The causal arrow can go in the other direction as well. If people are manipulated into harming someone, they can retroactively downgrade their opinion of the people they have harmed. Bandura found that about half of the participants who had shocked the victim explicitly justified their action. Many did so by blaming the victim, a phenomenon Milgram had noticed as well, writing things like, "Poor performance is indicative of laziness and a willingness to test the supervisor." Social psychologists have identified other gimmicks of moral disengagement, and Bandura's participants rediscovered most of them. They include minimizing the harm. It would not hurt them too bad. Relativizing the harm. Everyone is punished for something every day. And falling back on the requirements of the task. If doing my job as a supervisor means I must be a son of a bitch, so be it. The only one they seem to have missed was a tactic called advantageous comparison. Other people do even worse things. There is no cure for ideology, because it emerges from many of the cognitive faculties that make us smart. We envision long, abstract chains of causation. We acquire knowledge from other people. We coordinate our behavior with them, sometimes by adhering to common norms. We work in teams, accomplishing feats we could not accomplish on our own. We entertain abstractions without lingering over every concrete detail. We construe an action in multiple ways, differing in means and ends, goals and byproducts. Dangerous ideologies erupt when these faculties fall into toxic combinations. Someone theorizes that infinite good can be attained by eliminating a demonized or dehumanized group. A kernel of like-minded believers spreads the idea by punishing disbelievers. Clusters of people are swayed or intimidated into endorsing it. Skeptics are silenced or isolated. Self-serving rationalizations allow people to carry out the scheme against what should be their better judgment. Though nothing can guarantee that virulent ideologies will not infect a country, one vaccine is an open society in which people and ideas move freely, and no one is punished for airing dissenting views, including those that seem heretical to polite consensus. The relative immunity of modern cosmopolitan democracies to genocide and ideological civil war is a bit of support for this proposition. The recrudescence of censorship and insularity in regimes that are prone to large-scale violence is the other side of that coin. Pure evil, inner demons, and the decline of violence. At the beginning of this chapter, I introduced Baumeister's theory of the myth of pure evil. When people moralize, they take a victim's perspective and assume that all perpetrators of harm are sadists and psychopaths. Moralizers are thereby apt to see historical declines of violence as the outcome of a heroic struggle of justice over evil. The greatest generation defeated the fascists. The civil rights movement defeated the racists. Ronald Reagan's buildup of arms in the 1980s forced the collapse of communism. Now, there surely are evil people in the world. Sadistic psychopaths and narcissistic despots obviously qualify. And there surely are heroes. Yet much of the decline in violence seems to have come from changes in the times. Despots died and weren't replaced by new despots. Oppressive regimes went out of existence without fighting to the bitter end. The alternative to the myth of pure evil is that most of the harm that people visit on one another comes from motives that are found in every normal person. And the corollary is that much of the decline of violence comes from people exercising these motives less often, less fully, or in fewer circumstances. The better angels that subdue these demons are the topic of the next chapter. Yet the mere process of identifying our inner demons may be a first step to bringing them under control. The second half of the 20th century was an age of psychology. Academic research increasingly became a part of the conventional wisdom, including dominance hierarchies, the Milgram and Ash experiments, and the theory of cognitive dissonance. But it wasn't just scientific psychology that filtered into public awareness. It was the general habit of seeing human affairs through a psychological lens. This half-century saw the growth of a species-wide self-consciousness, encouraged by literacy, mobility, and technology, the way the camera follows us in slow-mo, the way we look to us all. Increasingly, we see our affairs from two vantage points. From inside our skulls, where the things we experience just are, and from a scientist's eye view, where the things we experience consist of patterns of activity in an evolved brain, with all its illusions and fallacies. Neither academic psychology nor conventional wisdom is anywhere close to a complete understanding of what makes us tick. But a little psychology can go a long way. It seems to me that a small number of quirks in our cognitive and emotional makeup give rise to a substantial proportion of avoidable human misery. It also seems to me that a shared inkling of these quirks has made some dents in the toll of violence and has the potential to chip away at much more. Each of our five inner demons comes with a design feature that we have begun to notice and would be wise to acknowledge further. People, especially men, are overconfident in their prospects for success. When they fight each other, the outcome is likely to be bloodier than any of them thought. People, especially men, strive for dominance for themselves and their groups. When contests of dominance are joined, they are unlikely to sort the parties by merit and are likely to be a net loss for everyone. People seek revenge by an accounting that exaggerates their innocence and their adversary's malice. When two sides seek perfect justice, they condemn themselves and their heirs to strife. People can not only overcome their revulsion to hands-on violence, but acquire a taste for it. If they indulge it in private or in cahoots with their peers, they can become sadists. And people can avow a belief they don't hold, because they think everyone else avows it. Such beliefs can sweep through a closed society and bring it under the spell of a collective delusion. Chapter 9. Better Angels. It cannot be disputed that there is some benevolence, however small, infused into our bosom, some spark of friendship for humankind, some particle of the dove kneaded into our frame, along with the elements of the wolf and the serpent. Let these generous sentiments be supposed ever so weak. Let them be insufficient to move even a hand or finger of our body. They must still direct the determinations of our mind. And where everything else is equal, produce a cool preference of what is useful and serviceable to mankind above what is pernicious and dangerous. David Hume, An Enquiry Concerning the Principles of Morals. In every era, the way people raise their children is a window into their conception of human nature. When parents believed in children's innate depravity, they beat them when they sneezed. When they believed in innate innocence, they banned the game of dodgeball. The other day when I was riding on my bicycle, I was reminded of the latest fashion in human nature when I passed a mother and her two preschoolers strolling on the side of the road. One was fussing and crying, and the other was being admonished by his mother. As I overtook the trio, I heard a stern mommy voice enunciating one word, empathy. We live in an age of empathy. So announces a manifesto by the eminent primatologist Franz de Waal, one of a spate of books that have championed this human capacity at the end of the first decade of the new millennium. Here is a sample of titles and subtitles that have appeared in just the past 2 years. The Age of Empathy, Why Empathy Matters, The Social Neuroscience of Empathy, The Science of Empathy, The Empathy Gap, Why Empathy is Essential and Endangered, Empathy in the Global World, and How Companies Prosper When They Create Widespread Empathy. In yet another book, The Empathic Civilization, the activist Jeremy Rifkin explains the vision. Biologists and cognitive neuroscientists are discovering mirror neurons, the so-called empathy neurons, that allow human beings and other species to feel and experience another situation as if it were one's own. We are, it appears, the most social of animals and seek intimate participation and companionship with our fellows. Social scientists, in turn, are beginning to re-examine human history from an empathic lens and, in the process, discovering previously hidden strands of the human narrative, which suggests that human evolution is measured not only by the expansion of power over nature, but also by the intensification and extension of empathy to more diverse others across broader temporal and spatial domains. The growing scientific evidence that we are a fundamentally empathic species has profound and far-reaching consequences for society and may well determine our fate as a species. What is required now is nothing less than a leap to global empathic consciousness, and in less than a generation, if we are to resurrect the global economy and revitalize the biosphere. The question becomes this: what is the mechanism that allows empathic sensitivity to mature and consciousness to expand through history? So it may have been the quest to expand global empathic consciousness, and not just a way to get a brat to stop picking on his sister, that led the roadside mom to drill the concept of empathy into her little boy. Perhaps she was influenced by books like Teaching Empathy, Teaching Children Empathy, and The Roots of Empathy, Changing the World Child by Child, whose author, according to an endorsement by the pediatrician T. Barry Brazelton, strives to bring about no less than world peace and protection for our planet's future, starting with schools and classrooms everywhere, one child, one parent, one teacher at a time. Now, I have nothing against empathy. I think empathy is, in general, though not always, a good thing, and I have appealed to it a number of times in this book. An expansion of empathy may help explain why people today abjure cruel punishments and think more about the human costs of war. But empathy today is becoming what love was in the 1960s, a sentimental ideal, extolled in catchphrases. What makes the world go round? What the world needs now? All you need, but overrated as a reducer of violence. When the Americans and Soviets stopped rattling nuclear sabers and stoking proxy wars, I don't think love had much to do with it, or empathy either. And though I like to think I have as much empathy as the next person, I can't say that it's empathy that prevents me from taking out contracts on my critics, getting into fistfights over parking spaces, threatening my wife when she points out I've done something silly, or lobbying for my country to go to war with China to prevent it from overtaking us in economic output. My mind doesn't stop and ponder what it would be like to be the victims of these kinds of violence and then recoil after feeling their pain. My mind never goes in these directions in the first place. They are absurd, ludicrous, unthinkable. Yet options like these clearly were not unthinkable to past generations. The decline of violence may owe something to an expansion of empathy, but it also owes much to harder-boiled faculties like prudence, reason, fairness, self-control, norms and taboos, and conceptions of human rights. This chapter is about the better angels of our nature, the psychological faculties that steer us away from violence, and whose increased engagement over time can be credited for declines in violence. Empathy is one of those faculties, but it is not the only one. As Hume noted more than 250 years ago, the existence of these faculties cannot be disputed. Though one sometimes still reads that the evolution of beneficence is a paradox for the theory of natural selection, the paradox was resolved decades ago. Controversies remain over the details, but today, no biologist doubts that evolutionary dynamics like mutualism, kinship, and various forms of reciprocity can select for psychological faculties that, under the right circumstances, can lead people to coexist peacefully. What Hume wrote in 1751 is certainly true today. Nor will those reasoners, who so earnestly maintain the predominant selfishness of humankind, be anywise scandalized at hearing of the weak sentiments of virtue implanted in our nature. On the contrary, they are found as ready to maintain the one tenet as the other, and their spirit of satire, for such it appears, rather than of corruption, naturally gives rise to both opinions, which have, indeed, a great and almost indissoluble connection together. If the spirit of satire leads me to show that empathy has been overhyped, it is not to deny the importance of such sentiments of virtue, nor their indissoluble connection to human nature. After hearing 8 chapters on the horrible things that people have done to each other and the darker parts of human nature that spurred them, you have every right to look forward to a bit of uplift in a chapter on our better angels. But I will resist the temptation to please the crowd with too happy an ending. The parts of the brain that restrain our darker impulses were also standard equipment in our ancestors who kept slaves, burned witches, and beat children, so they clearly don't make people good by default. And it would hardly be a satisfying explanation of the decline of violence to say that there are bad parts of human nature that make us do bad things and good parts that make us do good things. War I win, peace you lose. The exploration of our better angels must show not only how they steer us away from violence, but why they so often fail to do so. Not just how they have been increasingly engaged, but why history had to wait so long to engage them fully. Empathy. The word empathy is barely a century old. It is often credited to the American psychologist Edward Titchener, who used it in a 1909 lecture, though the Oxford English Dictionary lists a 1904 usage by the British writer Vernon Lee. Both derived it from the German Einfühlung, feeling into, and used it to label a kind of aesthetic appreciation, a feeling or acting in the mind's muscles. That's when we look at a skyscraper and imagine ourselves standing straight and tall. The popularity of the word in English language books shot up in the mid-1940s, and it soon overtook Victorian virtues such as willpower in 1961 and self-control in the mid-1980s. The meteoric rise of empathy coincided with its taking on a new meaning, one that is closer to sympathy or compassion. The blend of meanings embodies a folk theory of psychology that beneficence toward other people depends on pretending to be them, feeling what they are feeling, walking a mile in their moccasins, taking their vantage point, or seeing the world through their eyes. This theory is not self-evidently true. In his essay, On a Certain Blindness in Human Beings, William James reflected on the bond between man and man's best friend. Take our dogs and ourselves, connected as we are by a tie more intimate than most ties in this world, and yet outside of that tie of friendly fondness, how insensible each of us to all that makes life significant for the other. We to the rapture of bones under hedges, or smells of trees and lampposts, they to the delights of literature and art. As you sit reading the most moving romance you ever fell upon, what sort of a judge is your fox terrier of your behavior? With all his goodwill toward you, the nature of your conduct is absolutely excluded from his comprehension. To sit there like a senseless statue when you might be taking him to walk and throwing sticks for him to catch, what queer disease is this that comes over you every day of holding things and staring at them like that for hours together, paralyzed of motion and vacant of all conscious life? So the sense of empathy that gets valorized today, an altruistic concern for others, cannot be equaled with the ability to think what they are thinking or feel what they are feeling. Let's distinguish several senses of the word that has come to be used for so many mental states. The original and most mechanical sense of empathy is projection, the ability to put oneself into the position of some other person, animal, or object, and imagine the sensation of being in that situation. The example of the skyscraper shows that the object of one's empathy in this sense needn't even have feelings, let alone feelings that the empathizer cares about. Closely related is the skill of perspective taking, namely visualizing what the world looks like from another's vantage point. Jean Piaget famously showed that children younger than about 6 cannot visualize the arrangement of 3 toy mountains on a tabletop from the viewpoint of a person seated across from him, a kind of immaturity he called egocentrism. In fairness to children, this ability doesn't come easy to adults either. Reading maps, deciphering "you are here" signs, and mentally rotating 3-dimensional objects can tax the best of us. But that should not call our compassion into doubt. More broadly, perspective taking can embrace guesses about what a person is thinking and feeling, as well as what he is seeing. And that brings us to yet another sense of the word empathy. Mind reading.